Fenster dahin.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to episode 29 of the Criterion Reflections podcast. I am David Blakesley, and we're returning to our regular format this time. The last time out, episode 28, I had a sequence of interviews with some of my guests on Bob Rafelson's Five Easy Pieces. It turned into a pretty long episode, but I think it's very much worth the time to get some multiple perspectives on that, and a pretty important landmark film. Today we're going to kind of return our attention to the works of the precocious young Rainer Werner Fassbinder as we talk about the fourth film in the Eclipse series set, early Fassbinder. That was Eclipse Series 39. Talk about the fourth title in that sequence called The American Soldier. And this is a movie that I have written about. I kind of made it the first review that I wrote out of this set back in, I think, 2013, whenever it was released, for my Journey Through the Eclipse series. And then Trevor Barrett and I talked about this film on the Eclipse Viewer a few years ago, I think 2015 that was. So I have had a few encounters with this American Soldier, but to bring in some fresh perspective, I've got a couple guys who are podcasting together for the first time, but they're each making return appearances here. So Jason Beamish is my first guest. How are you doing today, Jason?
I am doing very well, sir. Thank you for having me.
It's good to have you back. It's been a while, so we'll have a chance to catch up with you and hear from you in a bit. But my other guest here, Robert Taylor. Robert, how are you?
A pleasure as always, David. It feels like it's been forever, almost a week.
Almost a week, yes. you were the last of the, or no, not the last, no, William did a sequence after you, but you were definitely one of the contributors to that Five Easy Pieces discussion, and I really appreciate your insights there. But you wanted to get on board the Fassbinder train as well. I don't think you've done any Fassbinder episodes with me, have you?
Nope. I decided, why not?
Why not? Why not jump in the mix? And we do talk a lot of Rainer Werner Fassbinder on this particular podcast. He was a guy who, of course, is pretty legendary for having produced a lot of films in a very short amount of time. And he happened to produce a lot of films in 1969 and 1970. So this is, I think, our fifth episode dedicated to RWF, the four films, Love is Colder Than Death, Katzenmacher, Gods of the Plague, and now this one. And also we talked about Baal, which was the kickoff episode for season two. It wasn't directed by Fassbinder, but he was certainly a pivotal star leading player in that film, of course directed by Volker Schlondorf. So we're seeing a lot of Fassbinder in this particular sequence here, and I'm very eager to hear what our guests have had to say about it, and I'll have a few hopefully fresh insights to toss into the mix as well. So, Jason, why don't you kind of give us a little summation, maybe your first take, tell us a little bit about what's going on in this film, and we'll roll it from there.
Good luck, Jason.
Thank you. Well, The American Soldier is a German-born American soldier who is returning to Munich, I believe, from Vietnam, and is thrust into the world of crime, which is similar to the current Fassbinder genres. And so he finds himself to be a hitman, but it's also, it feels sort of like a French new wavy, you know, many, many monologues that may or may not have anything to do with anything, and some killing. So I guess that's the high level.
Yeah, for sure. And of course, a little nudity, a little pornography, sleaze, and you know, it's all Fassbender's stock and trade here. Mm-hmm. And you know, you say he's thrust into the world of crime, and it seems to me like he's pretty much embraced it. He didn't have to be pushed all that hard. We don't get a lot of backstory on Ricky Murphy, or he's got another name of Van something, kind of an Italian sounding name. We'll just call him Ricky, but he's a man of mixed heritage there, and some pretty deep and presumably pretty twisted family conflict, and that all sort of emerges. But he's got the style down, that kind of white double-breasted suit, the fedora, the bottle of Ballantine scotch, the big old handgun, and that cold, implacable stare that says, "I'm here to do my business, and my business is killing you." So, yeah, that's basically the territory we're in. And, there's kind of some thematic connections from some of those earlier films, Love is Colder Than Death, and Gods of the Plague in particular. Robert, you want to give us kind of a first tee off on it as well? What do you think?
Well, I texted you as soon as I finished it, and I said, "What the fuck was this movie?"
Well, I got that text as well. I thought it was in that Visconti Ludwig sequence, because you had picked up a Ludwig as a super bargain, like for $7 or something at Amoeba, and I'm like, "That's cool. That's a great deal. That's a pretty deluxe set." So I thought you were watching Ludwig, and that was your comment on that. But no, this is you're commenting on this one. Listeners, to take you down some bunny trails there, but yeah, let's go back.
The first time I watched it seems like the movie is in slow motion. I watched it twice, and the movie is, what, an hour and 20 minutes long? It felt like it was 3 hours. It's all the characters are walking in slow motion. All of the scenes seem to happen in slow motion. That said, it's fascinating. It's a movie that I'm definitely never going to forget. There are moments in the movie that are so wild, so insane. They imply the craziness that Fassbender would later lean into. But here's how I feel. I don't like the movie at all, but I love parts of the movie. Does that make sense?
It makes a lot of sense to me. How about you, Jason? What do you think?
I agree with what he's saying. It reminded me in parts of like Alphaville, where it's so like dry, but there's something that keeps you engaged. But at the same time, I agree with your initial text review. it's very particular, peculiar, excuse me.
Well, it's both. I mean, there's a particular, kind of attitude, I think, that is what Fassbender's trying to cop here, is there's kind of a stance, a posture, a vibe of kind of jaded numbness, kind of an undercurrent of hostility at this shitty situation that everybody seems to be in. And again, this is pretty consistent theme through these early films. To me, it is. It's kind of a look at a kind of a broken, fucked up society where people are exploiting each other. Loyalties might seem somewhat meaningful on the surface, but they're snapped in an instant when some better proposition comes along. Let me ask, how much of you guys has seen of the earlier Fassbender films in this particular set?
None of the earlier movies.
Okay, so you haven't even seen him at all. Okay, that's helpful for me to know. How about you, Jason? What's your...
I watched Love is Colder Than Death, and you and I chatted about Gods of the Plague.
Right. So you've been following this journey here. So yeah. This is not as alien territory for you, maybe, as it is for Robert.
David, why do you even ask me anymore?
Well, people have ways of encountering films other than watching them for the sake of my podcast. I concede that your viewing habits are not completely dependent on whatever I'm doing here on Criterion Reflection. So I grant you that liberty, Robert. Go and flourish and prosper. But if this is your first plunge into Fassbender, I can definitely understand a little bit of that. I can select a few pieces here, but I didn't really enjoy myself. That was actually kind of my reaction the first time I reviewed this back when the set first came out, I had seen The Marriage of Maria Brown back in like the 90s. But that's kind of a very different Fassbender film from later in his relatively short career. And really, it was before I was into any of this Criterion-y stuff anyway, so it's kind of almost like a lifetime ago. As I've lived and sort of revisited this milieu that Fassbender puts together, I've certainly found my comfort zone in it. I'm not quite as put off by the amorality of it all. I've just sort of accepted that this is pretty much the Munich scene of 1969 and 1970. He seems to have grown up in it and is kind of trying to put its seedier aspects out there on full display. Yeah, and maybe he is, you know, hyping the melodrama a little bit or even cartoonizing some of the violence for effect. But I kind of feel like, yeah, this is the territory he was traveling in. And that's where, I guess, what do you want to call the truth or the gravity of this film comes through, even though some of it is, like I say, pretty absurd and sometimes almost comical, even though the events it's depicting are pretty sad and tragic if you think about them happening to real people in the real world.
And I do like many of Fassbender's later classic movies. However, I feel like this film, and you guys can correct me if I'm wrong, because Lord knows I didn't do research before I started recording this episode, but this felt like he was just basically trying to do Godard, right? The moments that worked best in the movie, I think, was when Fassbender was leaning into the things that would serve him best later in the in his career. The weird, melodramatic, over-the-top moments, the long speeches, one of which, of course, set up his best movie that I have seen, A Leaf Here Eats the Soul, right? Mm-hmm. But for the most part, the bits and bobs that did not work for me or the pieces that I'm not going to remember or felt really slow felt like he was just aping the French New Wave Godard movies from a decade prior. Am I insane?
No, I think, again, I've sort of made the point that Fassbender is kind of still a pretty young director. He's moving his focus over from the stage over to cinema, and he's kind of going with what he knows. Again, these are low-budget films made with his troupe of familiar faces and actors, although there's no Hanna Schygulla in this one and no Gunther Kaufmann, so he's given some other people a chance to step out front. And I think overall this is a pretty successful film for what he's trying to do, but keeping in mind he was cranking out 3 or 4 films a year, so he's not laboring and toiling over this. He's got a scenario, he puts it together, he films it, boom, it's out there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And Robert, to play off of what you were saying a minute ago about the Godard, it seems like it's, and I read this somewhere, it might have actually been David's review earlier, it's the marriage of that Godardian sensibility with like a John Huston noir film.
Yeah.
As he could interpret it. And so I got a lot of, you know, 40s noir, 30s and 40s noir when I was watching the movie.
And he name drops a ton of classic noir directors as well. So obviously he was wearing his heart on his sleeve in that case.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's kind of a fun little cinephile, whether it's a drinking game or just a tag or whatever, just like Murnau and who's the other one?
They mentioned Fritz Lang. And
yeah, right, mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. So it's little tributes there and you know, just putting characters in these kind of classic poses with deep shadows around them, you know, kind of, you know, pulling the gun out of the inside pocket of his jacket or the, you know, the glare, you know, the gaze across the bar, the kind of stiff body language that says you're messing with the wrong guy, I'm stabbing you in the back silently, you know, the undercurrents of corruption and exploitation that just kind of run rampant through the whole situation. So yeah, I guess maybe to spell out the plot a little bit as a refresher or to, you know, just engage with some of you know, themes and characters here. We basically got this American soldier, as Jason's described him, this Vietnam War vet. He's coming into Germany for a very express purpose. He's been called in to do some contract killings, and those killings have been ordered by a little trio of corrupt police officers who are getting pressure from their boss to, you know, clean up the docket there, to bring in a few scoundrels that they know pretty much have done the dirty deeds, but they haven't quite gathered the evidence or haven't quite got testimonials that'll, you know, convict these guys. And so this killer comes in at the cops' bequest because they want to kind of clean up the case their own way, I guess. They won't get the evidence. There's too much, you know, just not sufficient grounds that they can pull in the suspects. But if they get a hitman to just kind of knock off the ne'er-do-wells, then they can get back to their comfortable routines of sitting in shady bars playing poker with their dirty French postcard, their French playing cards there. So that's Ricky's situation. And like I say, we don't get really much backstory. We don't really understand maybe why he's so mercenary, so cold-blooded, but he certainly goes on to demonstrate just how, you know, numb, heartless, and cold-blooded he can be, because he pretty much flips the script on everybody, people that would have thought he was being friendly or at least approachable to their particular interest in him.
It reminded me, the storyline itself reminded me quite a bit of the classic noir Murder by Contract by Irving Lerner. Because he is essentially a contract killer who has no heart, has no soul. And I wonder if Fassbender was, because the movie was relatively unknown at the time, had somehow seen it, or it inspired him in any way. Have you guys seen that film?
No, I've never even heard of it. It's called Murder by Contract. That's the title. Okay.
Yeah, it's this classic noir from the 19, I think it might be early 50s, but Scorsese okay. is a huge fan of it. And Irving Lerner made like one or two movies after that, neither of which were good, but Murder by Contract is pretty incredible. It's one of those noirs where no one in it really did anything else after, so it sort of fell through the cracks, and then Scorsese saw it and was like, oh my god, this is the best. This is my Scorsese impression.
Yeah.
Oh my god, this is amazing. And so he does the DVD commentary and gets it released, and it gets rediscovered. And The American Soldier hews very closely to it in terms of story structure and the main character's motivations aside from the family stuff. So I'm curious if Fassbender might have been partially inspired by it. Jason, have you seen it?
I have not. I just put it on my watch list, though.
It's great.
Yeah, so do you want to go ahead, Jason?
Or
you
no, know? I was trying to think of, I think it might have been in one of the Indicator Hammer box sets. There was something also very similar to this story mm-hmm. of the contract killer. Obviously, there's, you know, probably hundreds of them, but that does sound interesting.
Yeah, do you think this story here catches sort of an essence of the film noir? Again, that guy who's just basically taking the phone call, tell me who the hit is, where to meet him, I'll knock him off, no questions asked. I mean, that's kind of a fascinating, kind of a scary character to. You know, come up against in the mm-hmm. course of watching films. You can obviously easily kind of overstate it, blow it, kind of overplay it in some way or another. But here, I think the characterization is handled pretty well. We're not looking for like a psychological analysis of this guy, but you know, we're trying to come to grips with what maybe led him into this situation. I don't know. I mean, you know, we could do a little armchair psychoanalysis. The guy does seem to have a bit of an alcohol issue, slugging his Ballantine scotch right from the bottle there, and just never batting an eye. And again, as the hits keep on coming throughout the film, he seems especially, well, not even cruel, that's not really the word, but just completely unaffected by any stage of relationship. I think especially the killing of Rosa, as we jump right into spoilers there. Rosa is the girlfriend of one of the head cops. He's pretty much the alpha cop of this little trio. The other two are pretty much his flunkies. But Ricky calls this number, says, send me a woman. I need a whore, and you guys got connections. So the cop sends Rosa, his girlfriend, presumably to, you know, protect confidentiality, if you will. Doesn't want Ricky telling his secrets to just some hooker off the streets. But he's also kind of, in a sense, punishing Rosa because, you know, he's got his own extra grind with her. But after Rosa and Ricky have gotten to know each other, after she's let it be known that she kind of cares for him, and particularly after he's asked her to travel with him to Japan, and they set up a little rendezvous, you know, a day or two later to make that break now that he's finished his business, she, you know, almost, you know, you wonder why would she trust this guy, but she does, and he ends up having to take her out because that's the next call he receives. He didn't know it at the time until he shows up and sees her, but it's like, oh, you're the one? Well, guess I got to do what I got to do. And while he's holding her in a passionate embrace, he pulls out his gun and you know, takes her life. And that's a pretty brutal way to leave this world, and it's a pretty brutal way to conduct yourself in it.
I also have to say I was kind of surprised with the brutality in the film, concerning the fact that there is very little blood, and when people are shot, they just crumple over as if it's a 1930s gangster.
Yeah,
movie.
Just a one shot and you're done. No, you know, no groaning, no grimacing, no thrashing around. Just, you know, I've done the deed and now your life is over.
Yeah, like
is that just low budget, you think, or what?
I have no idea. I think it might have been a choice for him going back, as if this is one long homage to film noir. It's him sort of going back to that, because I can't imagine, if he's so willing to show full frontal nudity, why he wouldn't go more bloody, unless it was a stylistic choice where he's going back to how things were in the 1940s noir movement.
Yeah. The only blood I recall seeing is when the hotel maid stabbed herself in the stomach after that breakup call with her boyfriend, very melodramatically, and then she comes out with an apron and it's all splattered, and that's about it. Is there anything else, any other blood or gore that anybody recalled?
I don't think so.
Not specifically, no.
So, what are some of the... Oh, let's talk about Ricky and his family situation.
Well, can we talk about Ricky for one more second? Because,
well, sure, of course, yeah.
I'm curious your opinions, guys. Because I don't know if it's a good performance in the drained face and emotion like Alain Delon in Le Samurai, or if it is a bad drained performance like George Raft in everything that he was ever in. I've never seen the actor in other films, unless he was in some Fassbender later that I didn't make a huge impact on me. So I'm unsure if he's actually a good actor doing a good job, or a bad actor who got cast in the right role.
Well, I guess it really comes down to how did he affect you? I mean, Carl Scheidt is his name, and he's kind of just one of these big, lunky, hunky type of guys who I think very much fits the mode of a Euro version of an American, you know? I can't remember the guy's name. If you guys have seen Mr. Freedom, you know, that was another kind of expat American who was living over in France at the time. But he's just, you know, he's probably about 6'4", you know, big chin, chiseled physique, not like bodybuilder type, but, you know, just kind of a solid, muscular American dude. And I think he just sort of fits that part. You know, he's bigger, presumably stronger, just a little bit more virile than your average, you know, European guy. He's just got that American Midwestern corn-fed thing going on, whatever it is. So I think he was probably directed for that flat affect. And I think that's kind of the psychology and persona that, that Fassbender was wanting to project. Just kind of a big lunk of a guy who just kills without really batting an eye. What was your response to Carl Scheidt's performance, Jason?
Well, a couple ideas here. One, this type of performance is somewhat typical in many of the other Fassbender movies that I've watched.
Yes.
Thinking specifically of Ali. Throughout the entire movie, except for save a few moments.
Except for when he was talking about couscous.
Yes. But it's possible at this point, if Fassbender's sick, calling him an American soldier, and he's just coming back from the Vietnam War, Munich is starting to gear up for the Olympics, so I imagine there's quite a bit of economic go-between between America and Germany at the time, and it's entirely probable that some of the people telling stories about the Americans returning from Vietnam were talking about how zombie-like they could be acting, just not being prepared psychologically to return to life.
And yeah. I think that's a pretty good analogy, or kind of a good connection, coming from, you know, the Vietnamese war zone. And again, another sort of Godardian connection. Godard, of course, at this time was very critical of the American involvement in Vietnam and that part of the world. And of course, the French preceded them, and he was very aware of that whole history there, maybe more aware himself than a lot of Americans were in terms of the background and the cultural context. But yeah, also, you know, the numbness, the drug addiction, the substance abuse that went on, even within the on-duty military at that time, and now you're back out of combat, but you're still looking for that, you know, way to get comfortably numb. I think, you know, it's not just the swagger of, hey, I'm chugging scotch straight from the bottle and hoisting my gun at you. It's just this kind of shut out the world, I can't handle it, but I'm not going to, you know, break down emotionally. I'm just going to stuff and bury all those feelings, and in the process become a very dangerous person if you cross me at the wrong time. So let's look a little bit at the family stuff. I think, Robert, you had said that, you know, this isn't really, the family stuff is kind of maybe a unique twist in terms of, you know, we don't always get into that kind of territory in your classic film noir, especially single mom and little brother who's got some pretty serious
Oedipal stuff going on.
Yeah, Oedipal stuff, incestuous. It's just kind of flat out weird. Who wants to take a stab at picking that whole thing apart? Because it's a very brief scene. You really don't get any hint of Ricky's family until an hour into the film, and like you say, with only 20 minutes left, there's not really a whole lot of time to explore that, but it is kind of set up for that, you know, pretty incredible finale, which I'm sure we'll have some things to say about when we get to that point in the conversation. But yeah, who wants to kind of psychoanalyze Ricky and his family issues there?
I mean, these sequences were the highlight of the film for me. What about you, Jason?
I was going to cede the floor to you.
Oh, in that case. Yeah, I mean, it was totally fucked up, but in a delightful way. The moment that he went in for the intimate kiss with the mom, and the mom turned away, I was like, oh, good, the movie's going to do something interesting now. And boy, did it get way, way, way more interesting really quickly. This, you could just list off the little moments in that sequence of events, and ostensibly each one of them would be in the top five for the things I liked about the movie. When the guy breaks the glass over the arcade game and then just like crunches it in his hand, although weirdly no blood, fantastic.
And well, mom says you did cut yourself, but he really mangled that thing, and it was only based on the news that Ricky was coming back. Ricky had made a phone call to mom from a phone booth, for those old-timers who remember those things, and he says, I'm back in Germany, I'm going to come up and visit you now, and she tells Kurt, I guess Kurt is the younger brother, and Kurt just kind of blows a gasket just on hearing that Ricky's going to be coming back. He just busts that whatever it is, a shot glass or whatever, right in his hand. And it was pretty remarkable. Like, whoa, that's a reaction for you.
Well, what I like most about the moment was, normally when you have scenes like that in film, they don't mean to shatter the glass, right? They're just standing there and then the glass accidentally shatters in their hand and they didn't realize that they were putting pressure on it. But in this case, that guy was like, no, I'm going to break this. Urgh.
Yeah, he's being theatrical, demonstrative. He's like, notice me, you know? And it seems like, yeah, there's some kind of weird inferiority complex or something, kind of playing up to his brother, looking for affection, looking for something that the brother just isn't quite ready to give.
Or something that the brother gave when they were younger and then realized was screwed up, and so he stopped giving it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's another angle to pursue or to speculate on there. So, yeah, so then Ricky comes in, and you're thinking there's going to be some kind of a moment, some kind of a statement, an encounter, but it feels very, I don't know, kind of, there's kind of this evasion that's going on, even though they're together, and then it wraps up. I mean, what kind of things happened in that family encounter that stood out to you, either of you guys?
Now I shall cede the floor to Jason, because I need a drink of water.
Okay. Well, first to kind of roll back into what possibly could be the brother's opinion, is this harkens towards the good son story from the Bible, where mm-hmm. the other son, who has this inappropriate relationship with his mother, has always been there for him while the brother has gone away.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's at this point in time, Ricky's an invading force into that family unit. So he might be a little way too high strung coming into that.
Yeah, there's definitely a pretty significant disruption going on here. But is the brother hoping that Ricky will stick around? Will Ricky will they reconcile with each other and be a family again? It doesn't seem like that's obviously not going to be the case. Ricky, almost within a few minutes, figures it's time for me to go. I've made my appearance. Mom has asked questions about my dad. He's let him know he doesn't travel in his dad's world. He didn't see his dad. He really has no mm-hmm. idea what's going on. And so maybe there's a bit of a disappointment there. But again, it's all kind of pretty elusive as far as what is dad? What is dad's situation? Why does he kind of cut off in mid-sentence about when he's about to describe whatever this issue or conflict is between the dad? Maybe Fassbender doesn't really want us to know. Maybe it's just one of those stated assumptions that, yeah, there's just kind of a pretty significant break. You know, dad was basically, he was there, you know, in the post-war years, just doing his duty, part of the, you know, the occupation force. Got together with the mom, went back to the States, and is doing what he does now, pretty much putting all that stuff behind him. So, yeah, I don't know. I have no idea how big of a subset of the German populace this was, these war orphans. You know, Gunther Kaufmann himself was, you know, the product of one of these kind of relationships. So this wasn't certainly a small, isolated, you know, minority. I'm sure it was probably a minority, but it was a sizable enough group that probably a lot of people could relate to that. You know, just kind of the chaos of the post-war years. You know, kids brought into this world by, you know, parents who are absent and not really knowing how to process all of that. So that kind of feeds into some of Ricky's disaffection here.
Did you guys wish that this last 20 minutes of the movie was actually the entire movie? Because that's how I felt.
I think it could have certainly been expanded upon, and I don't know if, again, it was just like Fassbender didn't really want to go there, or if he only had so many resources, or just really wanted to finish this project up, kind of pay his tribute to film noir, and then move on to other things. I mean, again, it's I've stated it before elsewhere, but these are not like the first five films he made in those years. He made like three or four or five other films, or was involved in other productions within the course of 69 and 70. So we've got five films in this Eclipse box, but he was doing other things, acting, directing, you know, co-script writing, whatever. He was just working at an unbelievable pace. So, yeah, to maybe draw out some more of these themes and maybe give us a little bit more of a satisfying backstory or a character portrayal of Ricky the American Soldier. Robert, let me just ask, you know, we just talked about Five Easy Pieces, and we talked about sort of the complications of that character, of Ricky Dupee, or Bobby Dupee, I'm sorry, I got my names mixed up there. But, you know, Bobby Dupee, who's kind of breaking away from his own family. Now, he's brought up in a very, you know, relatively speaking, very comfortable way of life and with lots of expectations and heavy parental guidance. That's not the situation here with Ricky, but yeah, I don't know. How do you maybe put these two character studies side by side?
I found Ricky more interesting, simply because he's much more of an enigma.
Robert, are you there?
Hang on one second. Oops.
Okay.
Can you hear me?
I whatever you were saying, I didn't hear. So.
Oh God, that was so important too.
well, we'll just work with your recording and get whatever we get out of it. But I don't know. Yeah. I mean, is there any fruitful food for conversation between Five Easy Pieces and American Soldier? Just put them next to each other like that.
I think that the interesting thing about both characters is what enigmas they are at the beginning. And as I think you alluded to, the first halves of Five Easy Pieces, and in the American Soldier's case, the first three quarters of the film, are exploring the character dissociated from his family life. And we're learning what he is like and how he has been influenced by his family, how it has turned the main character into this person who we see before us, before then rolling back the curtains and showcasing what the family life is like. And so, of course, there is a very interesting comparison to be made there. I don't think Jack Nicholson had killed anyone yet. We'll see what happens when he gets to Alaska. But, spoiler alert. it was very interesting watching these two back-to-back. I personally think Ricky is more of an interesting enigma for me, simply because Fassbender goes to lengths to not explain things that are explained in Five Easy Pieces. But that doesn't make the But that said, Nicholson gives a much better performance and engaged me more.
Yeah, and I think Five Easy Pieces is a
better movie.
It's a better movie. It's much more well-rounded. Its ambitions are obviously higher, and it's a product of a pretty lengthy bit of work and planning, from cinematography, screenwriting, supporting cast, all of that. You know, the American Soldier, I guess I'll say, is kind of a quick knockoff. I think it's substantial and it's interesting and it's worthy of, you know, consideration, but it's not really anywhere close to the kind of statement films that I think Fassbender would make later on, once he's kind of established himself and maybe even learned a few things more about how to make movies.
I'm so happy you said it, David, because if I said it, I feel like I would be turning into like the Criterion Reflections curmudgeon who every single time I'm on, I'm like, well, it might be a classic, but I didn't like it that much.
we don't want to pigeonhole you there, Robert. So I'm not going to certainly make greater claims for this film than what I think it deserves, which is, you know, this is part of a really impressive run. So taking it and standing it alone and saying here is the exemplary Fassbender work, that would not be doing justice to what I think even he was setting out to do here.
Did you guys pick up the weird metaphors for impotence throughout that I thought were really, really both over the top but not sketched out well enough, if that makes sense?
You're welcome to unpack them. I mean, I know that the one scene where we kind of get a glimpse of Ricky's bare ass there is he seems pretty flat, even though he's laying on the bed, he's naked, presumably he's ready for the woman to come through, but he feels pretty burned out at that point. Like, he's pretty much expecting the woman to do the work because he can't do much of it himself, you know? And again, there's just kind of this kind of selfish, carnivorous thing. Like, he's not really expected to do anything other than supply some money to get his needs met. I mean, the idea of an emotional connection, of the way he you know, grabs the hotel maid and just plants big kisses on her. But as soon as she's kind of thinking, hey, this might turn into something, he just sort of pushes her away. It's like he got what he needed, which wasn't much, and that's that. What are some of those other impotence metaphors that you might want to bring to our attention?
Well, you brought up two of the three, but the third one is in that early sequence when he literally is firing blanks between the girl's crotch, right?
Yeah, yeah. That's a pretty
on the nose
crazy scene. yeah, but you don't exactly know where it's going the first time you watch it. Is he just like straight up killing her? Like what? Or no, it's even, well, not worse in a way, but he's making an even bigger ass of himself. That was my reaction to that.
Yeah, exactly. But just when he was, because her legs are spread and her knees are up and he's literally firing in there. And then he goes, they're blanks. I was like, oh, I think it's a metaphor.
Yeah. And then just laughing about it, like, you know, haha, isn't that funny? That actress is Irm Herman, who was pretty key player in some of the later Fassbender films, but kind of a bit part here.
For not having much to do, she really made quite an impact in her just little bit of screen time.
She's basically a pickup here. She's just riding in the front seat and taking a few hits off his bottle and filling the time with some aimless chatter there. And after he's had his fill of her, it's like, okay, you're out. Again, one of those kind of first reveals of just what a cold-hearted son of a bitch he really is.
The other scene... But, oh, go ahead, Jason.
I was just going to say that the love scene in American Soldier, if you call it love scene, it plays very similarly to what he had produced in Gods of the Plague.
Are you talking about the bedroom scene?
Yeah, I guess that'd be the most apt way to say it.
So that's Ricky and Rosa on the mattress, in the buff, while the maid, Margarita Ventrata, she gives her little weird monologue. What would you make of that? That was just kind of a strange little moment.
That was the moment when I realized that in this specific film, Fassbender wanted to make a French movie. That's really the best I could take from it. It just was completely out of place. I imagine it was a very important soliloquy to him.
And what was she talking about? I mean, I can't remember. I mean,
she gave us the plot of Ali Firit's The Soul, except with a darker ending.
Yeah, that's right.
And I love that. I love it when filmmakers plant seeds of movies that they're going to make later. Like Almodovar did it with Flower of My Secret, and then he paid it off with Volver. So obviously, Fear Eats the Soul was something that Fassbender had been sort of obsessing over for quite some time, which made me happy.
Thank you for catching that, Robert. Yeah, because I do recall reading somewhere that soliloquy there had some kind of meaningful connection, but I couldn't quite draw it out there. So
I mean, a little darker, but
yeah, for sure. So yeah, I, you know, like I say, for listeners who want to hear other takes, I've written about it. Trevor and I did our thing on the Eclipse Viewer. I'll put links for those in the show notes. But any other kind of major observations or rabbits you want to pull out of the hat about this film? I think it's decent. I've enjoyed the conversation so far. I want to kind of give you guys a chance to kind of throw any of our little riffs out there that you might have for our listeners.
When I was a student at the American Film Institute Conservatory, we, over the course of our first and second year, made three, we called them cycle projects, but they were short films, and they were almost always awful. Like, this was us trying to figure out how to make movies and how to properly operate, you know, how to be cinematographers, be directors, write short films, etc., etc. And every now and then they were great, and even the bad movies often had good moments in them, but they still, by and large, were pretty meh. And that's how I sort of feel about American Soldier. It has little bits and bobs where I think to myself, wow, okay, he obviously has this really interesting voice as a filmmaker, but then long sections where characters are just wandering around, literally wandering around and doing nothing, where you're thinking he's either padding running time or he doesn't quite know what he's doing or how to tap into that power yet. That's what the movie was to me. And I know we're going to still talk about the ending, but...
Yeah, right.
That was Jason, my overall.
Jason, help me out here. What was that? Is it Love is Cold, or is it Gods of the Plague or Katzenmacher, where they have the characters literally walking for long stretches, like
straight... Gods of the Plague.
Is Gods of the Plague. Robert, or yeah, if you want to see characters just walking around, go check out Gods of the Plague, because literally there are just these reverse dolly shots of the characters walking straight into the camera with the camera being pulled backwards for, like, it seems like 4 minutes at a time, just talking to each other. So if you think that was happening here, well, you ain't seen nothing yet, baby.
I will make sure to put that right at the top of my queue, I say jokingly.
and if you walk away from this, no intended pun, and you still need more, I would highly recommend you look out Satan Tango if you haven't yet, That's got about eight, four hours of walking.
Okay, well, yeah, so Fassbender had his influences, I guess, and he left his own influences on Bellatar and others. So, you know, let's talk about that ending. So, Jason, this is, you know, I think, were you who said this was kind of slow motion? I think Robert said this was kind of like in slow motion. Well, we literally get slow motion the last few minutes of this film. We've already heard the song by this point in the movie, So Much Tenderness, or whatever the name of that song is. It's been played, and there's another little musical bit that's used pretty frequently throughout the film, but we finally get the full sort of extended vocal treatment and all of that. Jason, what did you think of that ending? How did that strike you?
Oh my goodness, that ending. I thought it for a moment that we would lead directly from Five Easy Pieces into this when talking about the ending, just like one of the finest dramatic performances of all time, and then of the American Soldier. One thing I like about Filmstruck is here we are talking about it. I have this just running in the background. Mm-hmm. I just clicked over to it, and it is maybe the most bizarre death scene that I've ever witnessed. And I like bad horror movies.
Yeah, so, right. Yeah, for a horror movie fan, that's a high praise indeed.
It's just absolutely bonkers.
Yeah, but it's not really a lot going on. It's just the way it's played out and the way it sort of unravels right in front of your eyes. This emotion, this physicality, just
this humping, you know.
It looks like he found his cure for impotence, though. It's being murdered and just dry humping your dying friend. If that's not the takeaway, I'm not sure what is.
Well, you know, it's literally get it while you can. But yeah, so as a refresher for maybe listeners who haven't seen the movie in a while, Ricky recognizes his tinglers are going off, that he's got an appointment at the lockers where he's got a gun in storage. He's recognizing that the walls might be closing in. His police guys who've been contracting with him might be setting him up to take a fall. You know, he's done the business. Now he knows that, you know, he's kind of a wanted man himself. He knows too much, and he might be in trouble. So he kind of connects with his friend Franz Walsh, one of those names that Fassbender loved to recycle, and sometimes it's the same character, sometimes it's different. Sometimes we're not really sure if this is a continuity thing or what, but Fassbender himself plays Franz Walsh, a side character, but they meet up at the bus station or whatever it is. Franz gets the drop on the cops after they've already gotten Ricky to stick his hands up, but then they're momentarily distracted when Ricky's mom and little brother show up and call his name. That gives the cop just that key moment to grab the gun, fire two deadly shots, sends the guy sprawling, and then the music kicks in, the slow-mo takes over, and Kurt basically just goes for the gusto as his brother is dying in his arms. And yeah, it was quite a unforgettable scene. Robert, what's your take on all that?
I mean, my take was good for him. Go Go for your happiness, bro. I agree that it is one of the most memorable death scenes I've ever seen in a film. And I would say, in terms of murder, have you ever seen Santa Sangre, Jason?
I have not, no.
I have not, no.
Okay. Well, if you watch that, there is a scene... Never mind. I'm not even going to spoil it. I'm just going to say that there is a murder that tops this one. But this is definitely something... This is definitely the one moment where everything else from the movie will probably fade. But... this is going to stick with me for the rest of my life, probably. I'm not saying if it's going to be in a good way or a bad way, but it's definitely sticking in my gourd.
Yeah, it's definitely occupying some brain space. It's burned itself into your hard drive and not to be erased, you know? So, and you could make the case that The American Soldier is kind of like a 76-minute setup for those last... 3 or 4 minutes of the film, you know, just to kind of put you in that moment there. And it is... kind of fascinating to wonder, where did Fassbinder get this vision? You know, he wrote the lyrics to this song, and those lyrics are sung in English as well, so you'll get a chance to hear it on the outro there. But yeah, it's just, and the chorus, so much tenderness inside my head, so much loneliness inside my bed. Kind of says it all, doesn't it, there, mm-hmm. Yeah, as far as from a certain perspective.
And the other thing is, he doesn't do a classic fade out or put at the end or anything like that. The movie literally ends mid-hump, which...
Yeah, it's a very hard out, right. no pun intended, guy.
Okay, sorry.
I guess this whole podcast was a sort of a setup for that one liner.
Did you think of it beforehand, David? Just be honest.
No, that was completely in the moment, spontaneous. But it might be a pretty good note to go on.
Yeah, we can't top it.
I have nothing to add.
Okay. Well, I think this conversation has run its course. So thank you for joining me on this here in Michigan anyways, this rainy Saturday afternoon. It's September. We're getting into quality movie season, right? Is that right? The summer blockbusters are over, so we're going to be getting highbrow here.
I'll tell you what, two of the movies that I'm most excited for, they're waiting for the fall, so I'm ready for them.
What are they?
The Halloween and Suspiria.
Oh, yes, of course. Getting all kinds of chatter and buzz out there. Robert, you got any cinematic highlights you're looking for?
Well, as soon as we get off of recording, I will tell Jason exactly what I thought of Halloween.
Ooh, okay, well.
Sneak preview. Guys, I got the rest of you.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, and unfortunately, we don't have any Patreon bonus episodes or anything like that, so you're going to just have to wait, listeners. I don't have an unedited raw feed to send out there. So,
but yeah, I can't wait for Suspiria either. Call Me By Your Name was my favorite movie of 2017, so this is going to either really let me down or be everything that I wanted it to be. I don't think it's going to be anywhere in the middle.
Excellent. Okay, guys, well, you want to put any shout-outs, any links, projects, things you're working on, any business that you want to promote of your own to our listeners? Jason, you got a website, links, anything you've been up to lately?
Well, I write over at filmruminations.com somewhat regularly, and I can be found on Twitter and Facebook and all the normal haunts.
Cool. What have you been posting about recently?
Well, I'll tell you what. I just watched the new Olive Signature release of Bound.
Oh, yeah. I saw you posted a link to that. Yeah, and I took a glance there. Yeah, is it a good release?
It's dynamite. If you don't have the Arrow one,
yeah,
I would get this one.
I think I will. I have Olive Signature complete except for that one, which just came out. And I think I'll keep the string going there. Cool.
Yeah, it looks great.
Excellent. Robert, how about you? Anything you want to kind of plug while we had a minute?
Spirit Season 6 is on Netflix. Yay! I'm trying to think if there's anything else. Check out my blog, therobertaylorodyssey.blogspot.com, if you haven't yet already. And let's face it, if you've listened to the podcast and haven't checked at this point, you're probably not going to, but I figured I'd say it anyway.
I'll just insist on it. Listeners, please check out their links. These are good guys. putting good content out there. And I really appreciate both of you, Robert and Jason, getting together with me today. So thank you for your contributions. We will see you both down the road. You're on the slate for future episodes.
Love you, David.
Excellent. I'll be back soon with an episode on Equinox, the kind of homegrown backyard horror film from 1970. Oh. So I'm looking forward to that. We will see you all next time, folks. Goodbye.
Now and then I'll feel this torn, my friend, and hope was born again. So much tenderness is in my head, so loneliness is in my bed, so much tenderness over.